Last night, vice presidential nominee Paul Ryan and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice revved up Republicans in Tampa. What's the view from the delegates on the convention floor? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, we'll talk with Iowa delegates at the GOP convention in Tampa, find out their thoughts on this final day of the convention, and ask them to size up the challenges they face in the final weeks of the campaign. Then author Michael Perry gives us a glimpse of rural Wisconsin in his new book, Visiting Tom, A Man, a Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. All coming up this hour, first a look at the news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last night, Condoleezza Rice and Paul Ryan revved up the Republican convention in Tampa, Florida. Today, the final day of the convention, and tonight, Mitt Romney will officially accept his party's nomination for president. Joining us now from Tampa live, three Iowa delegates to the GOP convention. Drew Ivers is the chairman of the Iowa delegation. Drew, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you very much. If you have something on in the background, please turn that down. We may be getting a little bit of an echo from that. Will Johnson is with us as well by phone. Will Johnson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for joining us. And Representative Glenn Massey, a delegate. Glenn Massey, are you there?
I am.
Very good. All of us on board. I want to turn to you first, Drew Ivers, as chairman of the Iowa delegation. All three of you are actually Ron Paul supporters, as I understand, as is the large majority of the Iowa delegation, 22 of 28 delegates supporting Ron Paul. Explain how this happens, given that Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney were the two top winners on caucus night in Iowa.
I'd like to take first shot at that, and it will be somewhat informative, I think, of your audience, because there's a great deal of confusion in terms of what the Iowa caucuses are. The Iowa caucuses, it is a delegate selection process. This year in Iowa, it started January the 3rd, then it moved at the caucuses, then it moved to county conventions, then district conventions, then state conventions, and now a national convention. And so delegates are selected at each level. In other words, delegates selecting delegates, delegates selecting delegates.
Mm-hmm.
The straw poll that happened, coincidentally, on, I'll add that word deliberately, on January 3rd, is not official party business. That is what it says, a straw poll. Now, what has happened is, over time, people have gotten confused and thinking that the straw poll is the caucus process. Well, in fact, it is not. And so the media has doesn't quite see the picture, and many Republicans don't see the picture, that it is a delegate selection process. And so there's the explanation. So the poll campaign honored the system, sought to secure delegates at each level, and so it was a simple process of normal politics of getting out the vote at each of those levels.
Mm-hmm. Did you, Will Johnson, as a Ron Paul supporter, go into this convention thinking that Ron Paul would get more out of it than he evidently has?
Well, I'd just like to say that after coming here and seeing the caucus process, in some ways I am pleasantly surprised. We had a much stronger showing in numbers than was reflected in the final delegate count. A lot of that is due to some of the procedural motions and rules in each state that has to do with primary versus caucus. But as far as expectations, you know, in politics, you run to win.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, then, you know, you move on and figure out what you're going to do next.
So what is the impact of Ron Paul supporters at this convention that you can see now?
I think one of the biggest impacts is that they know that we're here to stay, we're not going away, and that not only were they wrong in their initial assessment of people that support the Constitution and limited government as quote-unquote fringe, they realize that, you know, we are becoming the mainstream of the party and that they need to readjust themselves, because the youth and the energy, that's the next generation. You know, people, as they get older, they don't last forever. They tend to die off, and then the younger generation comes up, and the ideas that come with them stay within the party, which is what's happening right now. It's a healthy process, and, you know, I've come to respect it a little bit more. And granted, obviously, we didn't get everything we wanted, and there were some rules issues, but right now we're looking to for the next 4 years, and if the exponential growth curve that's happened in the last four continues, we're going to be in a clear majority this next cycle, and I'm pretty excited about it.
You're talking about clear majority, the libertarian wing of the Republican Party.
Well, when you say libertarian wing, I think there's some distinctions that need to be drawn, because, you know, there's everybody has, like, different definitions for liberty or libertarian.
Right. I'm saying that because Ron Paul has, in fact, run for president as a libertarian.
That's true, and that was his first attempt back in, you know, the 1980s. But after that, he ran twice now, and he's always been a Republican as an elected congressman. We're talking about 30 years of public service. So if you really want to, you know, split hairs here, just look at what Ronald Reagan said. Ronald Reagan said the heart of conservatism is libertarianism. You know, you can't have self-responsibility and auto-determination without the understanding that each person, if they make their own decision, then they need to, you know, respect the consequences that come with it. And so for a lot of us, we're just trying to pull them back, not just the party, but the rest of the nation, and understanding that you can't live in a dependent status. It not only is it immoral, it just simply doesn't work.
Glenn Massey, let me turn to you. You're a representative from Warren County near Des Moines, also a Ron Paul supporter, as the Will Johnson and Drew Ivers are. Will just mentioned the rule change here. Explain to us, help us understand, what was the rule change that you were fighting for, and what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome, it turned out to be a compromise that probably, I think, Dr. Drew and Will would agree, it was really not acceptable. It is an attempt, there's no other way to put it, it is an attempt by the establishment portion of the Republican Party at the hierarchy level, attempting to suppress the grassroots effort that we have seen rise up through this this process. As Will correctly explained, you know, we started out, and Drew did too, we started out in our local precincts, and we won, and we went to our counties and our district and state, and you know, we followed the rules as they were written and arrived at this place where now the rules are being changed to attempt to suppress our opinions and views that we were elected to bring to the convention. And just to build on that a little bit, one of the best things that happened at this convention was there was moments there where we actually had, I'm going to call it a real convention. It actually, like the other processes, had a give and take to it for a moment. Even though we were shut down fairly quickly, at least it was heard instead of being just a three-day infomercial. And I think that the people out in America have recognized that the convention process has become that. It has become a four-day party. And the media has recognized we're giving the party a free television commercial, and they recognize the insincerity of it. That the people of America, they want real people involved in the process to reclaim this nation back to its roots. And that would be, as Dr. Drew says, a smaller federal government. It has grown massively huge. It's nowhere close to the enumerated powers that the founders gave us in the Constitution. And that's what this movement is about, is to try to, again, shrink the size of the federal government and get them out of our business, let so many of the issues that the federal government is involved in be replaced at state levels. And that's exactly what the founders had in mind.
If you want to spend a little more time on the rules, I could add a little bit more to that.
Yeah, the Drew Ivers, I believe that's you. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, there were several rule changes proposed in the Rules Committee meeting, which is the National Convention Rules Committee. One of them was to dictate that delegates would be bound by popular vote. In other words, the straw poll, and let me emphasize, a straw poll is what a straw poll says it is. It's a straw poll. But that rule would say, well, whatever the straw poll percentages were, that's how the delegates would be apportioned. Well, that got watered down a bit. I'm not seeing the very final language. The second one was that the rules, the national RNC, Republican National Committee rules, could be changed by the RNC with a 75% vote of the RNC without going through the national delegates at a national convention, for example, 4 years from now. Well, that's not good either. The third, then, is that delegates would be bound to vote for the nominee that they were committed to. In other words, they would have to vote for that individual, and they could not nominate a different one. The last one was the most egregious, and it was changed. And it was that the presidential candidate could dismiss or disavow any delegate that they wished that was selected by the body of the convention at the state. Well, that is not, has nothing to do with candidates, has nothing to do with issues, has nothing to do with conservative versus liberal. It's a representative government, grassroots, bottom-up representation, and it's being tampered with and violated, and the majority of the delegates in that rules committee disavowed that, and they said that cannot stand, and it was dropped.
And so that would have allowed the candidate or the nominee choose the delegates that he or she wanted, just like that, with that rule.
Yeah, just like that. So let's say 100 delegates were selected, and the candidate would say, you know, these 10 over here, I don't think they're loyal enough to me. I disavow those 10. So you got to get 10 others.
So for all, just a minute, just to be clear on that point, Drew. So that could have meant that all three of you would not have been at the convention. You would have been ruled out as not loyal enough to Mitt Romney.
Well, that's very possible. Very possible that could have happened. Now, this is the rule that was proposed for 4 years from now.
Okay, so this part of the rule didn't pass. David Fisher tweeted this, another Iowa delegate, also Ron Paul supporter. Here's his quote from his tweet. Lots of conservatives mad about rule changes, not just Paul supporters. Christian right, Tea Party types, etc., all Iowa delegates. A fair characterization of how the Iowa delegation feels?
I'll chime in, and the other two guys can too. Yes, very much so. It was not driven, my understanding, it was not driven by the Ron Paul delegates. We had about 190 delegates on the floor, a pretty small minority. So out of 22, 88. So we're not talking about an overwhelming force here. So the majority of the delegates were non-Ron Paul, including on the Rules Committee. So it was driven by non-Ron Paul delegates.
Okay.
To add a point to that,
is this Glenn or Will?
No, this is Will Johnson.
All right, go ahead, Will. Sorry.
To add a point to that, one of the biggest concerns about those kind of rule changes, there was a Rule 16 and a Rule 14 that caused us a lot of concern. Is once you start taking the emphasis off of the caucus process, that's when big money gets more and more involved. I don't know if you know what the difference. Your audience probably would. Florida was a primary state. You had to throw millions of dollars at that state to have a win. Now, the people there, I'm fairly certain most of them have not even met any of the candidates. Whereas in Iowa, they have to come through consistently over and over again and meet everybody face to face. And the people, passion is rewarded, not big dollars. And so I think a lot of your audience can understand the problem of money in politics. So when you start changing rules so that caucuses are disrespected and primaries are basically the majority, then that's where bigger money becomes involved. And that was one of our concerns.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking live with three delegates, Iowa delegates, to the GOP convention going on now in Tampa. Will Johnson, Glenn Massey, and Drew Ivers. Drew Ivers, the chairman of the Iowa delegation. And tonight, Mitt Romney will officially accept your party's nomination for president and give a speech being touted as his most important political speech thus far. Given what you've just described, you all as Ron Paul supporters, how do you feel about supporting Mitt Romney tonight? Can you give it your whole heart there, Glenn Massey?
I definitely can't give it my whole heart. He has to earn that support, just like Ron Paul did. And so we'll look at what the man has to say and consider what he is offering us.
Okay, so Glenn Massey, what in particular would you want to hear from him tonight that you think would help him gain your confidence and put him in the White House?
I'd actually like to hear him expressed that he would actually attempt to uphold the Constitution and actually move towards smaller government. And that's one of my concerns, some of the things on the campaign trail that he expressed support for, in all honesty, didn't vary much from what we have in President Obama. And so I'm looking for the differences, not the similarities. And unfortunately, with the nominee, there's a lot of similarities.
Will Johnson, what are you looking to hear from Mitt Romney this evening?
Sure. I would say I look for the same thing that I look for in other candidates. I'll give you an example, okay? I happen to be currently running in a state Senate race in District 50 against Senator Pam Yocum. I just won my primary as a Ron Paul supporter. Now, I live by the phrase that liberty has no permanent enemy. If Romney were to have a Paul on the road to Damascus, miraculous conversion experience, he would have wholehearted support. But since that hasn't happened and may or may not, we have to see him. You know, we have to see what he has to say. It's just like anything else in politics. If everybody were to roll over and say, you know what, we're just going to fall behind the guy because X, Y, or Z, then the issues that we are trying to drive, which is a constitutional spending limit, everything that has to do with reducing the deficit, we would have a much harder time trying to drive that point home than if we said, hey, listen, we need these points taken seriously for us to take you seriously. So he'll have a speech tonight and he'll have his chance to make his statement, but, you know, he's got a lot of work to do.
Okay, Drew Ivers, in your opinion, what work does Mitt Romney have to do, and what words do you want to hear from him tonight?
Certainly. I will answer that very quickly, but before I do, I do want to give a quick summary to what we were talking about, rules changes. The basic problem that we were faced with the rules, is typical of the whole political movement that we're a part of, and that is it was starting to dictate more and more top-down governance versus grassroots bottom-up governance. And so we're constantly trying to defend bottom-up grassroots government. And so those rules challenge that, and we push back. Now, as far as Romney is concerned, I'm favorable. I mean, I'm hoping that Romney will understand and continue moving this party to its traditional roots that we came from. I think many Republicans will acknowledge that we've drifted farther to the left than we once were and where we want to be. And I think I'm hopeful that Mitt Romney will identify that and be more specific about how he's going to cut spending, how he's going to work toward solving our foreign involvements, because they are also bankrupting. Look at some sound money issues that we're having right now, terrible amount of inflation that we're in the midst of. And a free, he is talking good terminology on free markets, and I'm supportive of that. And we want to keep emphasizing, I hope he continues to grow and move toward more individual free citizenship. In other words, the individual liberties that made this country great. So I'm hopeful that he will hear the signals. That's what we accomplished on Wednesday night when we cast our vote, that we said, look, we want to restore the roots of the Republican Party, and the Republican Party is the party of small government. Now, people don't want small government. They want big government. They can vote for the Democrats. So we're in the process of helping restore and revive the Republican roots of small government and actually do it. Now, Republicans, and I'm one of them, I've been involved for 4 years, we do a wonderful job talking small government, but the debt is still $16 trillion. You can't deny that. We had it on a big sign at the convention. It's still there. It's ticking away right now. And so that tells you right there that we have a problem. And those things get passed by large votes. And there are Republicans that are participating in this to some degree that we need to wake up, recognize, be honest to the reality that there's too much spending, and we need to be more proactive in bringing that under control and not just lip service.
Drew Ivers, I'm getting word that you have to go, or can you stay with us for the few remaining minutes we have?
I think I am okay for the next few minutes.
Okay, picking up on the point there, I'm wondering if this has anything to do with the fact that George W. Bush, the last Republican president, was almost entirely or entirely left out of this GOP convention. Does that reflect a change in the party?
Well, who would you like to?
Well, let's go to Glenn Massey or the person who just laughed, perhaps.
Well, that was
Glenn Massey here.
Okay, is that Glenn?
This is Glenn here. Yeah, George really wasn't totally left out. They did have a video clip of George and Herbert Walker Bush on last night, where they basically talked about his presidency and his father's presidency and their support for Romney. So it would be disingenuous to say that there's an absence of the Bushes in this convention. They did have their 15 minutes of video fame, I guess you could say, and I think they did a good job of talking about what
that's
George
was
remembered for.
A pretty thin slice, considering you have a 3-day convention, wouldn't you agree?
I understand, but there are literally hundreds of speakers and new people that are coming up upon the scene that need to be exposed to the population, and they need to move forward, not necessarily look back all the time.
Will Johnson, a comment on that?
Other than my laughing and smirk.
Let me ask you this then, Will Johnson. How has the convention, these few days of the convention, changed your thinking about your party, the GOP?
Well, that's actually a pretty pertinent question. This is my first convention. Hey, I've been involved for about 4 or 5 years. And, for me, it was seeing I enjoyed the process in Iowa, because in Iowa we have a very dedicated, all the way from the precinct up to the state level. You can get involved, you can be passionate, and even at the state convention, you can have a voice and you can be heard. Now here, I see it as we're just making inroads. We still weren't able to make different points of order or divisions because, they had the microphones turned off and they were playing their games. But my brother was at it 4 years ago, Jeremiah Johnson, who was on the State Central Committee, and we talked about it. He said, our presence this time is vastly, vastly different, which meant that they had to respect us more. Now, granted, is it perfect? I don't think so. But I view it in a little bit of a different term. When you asked before about Romney or about George Bush or even about Obama, I view those people as basically just symbols. In person, they're probably all very nice and cordial. But what do they symbolize? Obama, we all know that symbolizes, obviously, large government. You can call it socialism, communism, collectivism, and a mix of corporatism in there. Romney, we're still trying to see what exactly does he symbolize, because up till now, we all know this. There's been different symbolism in different areas, and he knows this. This isn't anything that they would deny. They're trying to figure out where they're at. And a lot of us, we know specifically where we stand and what we want to be represented, which is smaller government, more individual liberty, and the idea that perhaps the government is not the answer to all of life's problems.
Thank you all. We've run out of time. Thank you very much, Will Johnson, Representative Glenn Massey, and Drew Ivers, Chairman of the Iowa delegation. It's been insightful, giving us your view from the convention in Tampa. Thank you very much on this last day of the GOP convention.
Can I answer just a 10-second summary? And that would be that the Republican Party is definitely moving more to the right, and we're part of that movement, and we think it's healthy, and we think it's proper.
Drew Ivers, thank you very much for that last word. When we come back, author Michael Perry gives us a glimpse of rural Wisconsin in his new book, Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. When we continue, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you so much for joining us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is Michael Perry. In his book, Population 485, he introduced us to New Auburn, Wisconsin, the raging fires, smelt feeds, car wrecks that brought him to his hometown as a firefighter and EMT. In his book, Truck, A Love Story, he took us on a year-long ride as he struggled to fix his 1951 International pickup and sort out his love life along the way as well. In his book, Coop, he shared the joys and challenges of putting down roots in a ramshackle farmhouse. And in his latest work of nonfiction, Michael Perry tells the tale of Tom Hartwig, an old-timer best known for locally building and firing homemade cannons. It's titled Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. Author Michael Perry joins me in the studio today. welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back in Iowa City.
We want to mention that you will be giving a reading this evening at Prairie Lights in downtown Iowa City at 7 p.m.
You bet.
Introduce us a little bit more to Tom Hartwig, a neighbor of yours in Wisconsin. Who is he, and what made you realize he would be such a great subject for your book, which he is? I've been delighted reading this book.
He's a great guy, and you know, originally I was going to write a book about old-timers, and I was going to profile 10 old-timers, and I ran into a couple of problems with that. One was that I let the word out and immediately was deluged with hundreds of emails, and there's just no way to sort through it because the truth is Aunt Mabel and Spooner, Uncle Joe and Des Moines, you know, they all deserve a full book treatment. And I just realized there was no way I could divvy it up and choose 10. And so I changed focus to Tom because he's right there. He's my neighbor. He helps me out. And the other thing I really wanted to do was write a book about what you can learn from just being neighbors. And I really went out of my way to not make this one of those books where he's my mentor, I'm his acolyte, I study at his feet seeking wisdom. And like, no, I need a piece of rebar cut, bent, or welded. And so I go over to Tom because he's got a metal lathe and a cutting torch and a welder, and he knows how to use them.
And decades of wisdom and skills. He's in his 80s?
He's 82 right now, yeah. Or he may have just turned 83. And then he... You just learn from being around him. And you don't learn from interviewing him. He does not respond well to the interrogatory. I have a couple of moments in the book where I break the rule of just hanging out and actually ask him specific questions. One about – he has two daughters. I have two daughters. And I ask him about, you know, very seriously about advice for being the father of daughters. And the answers he comes up with are almost unprintable.
Well, you know, the word that he used most often as you quote him in the book, and perhaps you can imitate it, is – well,
yeah, he's got this.
Does he do that?
Prefaces
can you
a lot.
Do better than I can? Probably.
Well, I don't know what better, but I know what he sounds like, and he prefaces so many of his responses with the word "well." Only he says "well," you know, and off he goes. And, yeah, so he just it seemed natural, and it was fun to be able to write about someone just at the pace of everyday life, rather than putting him up on a pedestal or isolating him in some other fashion.
Tom collects cannons. Why? What does he do with them?
You know, he's a Civil War history buff, and just a history buff in general. He's a very well-read fellow. I call him a roughneck polymath. He can do it all. He talks in the book about his team of oxen, Chester and Lester, that he used to take to parades, and he talks about making his own oxbows. But he also has a metal lathe, and he'll quite proudly point out that the most recent patent on that lathe is somewhere around 1918. And yet he's still making – I've been there within the last 6 months when he's making parts on that ancient lathe for some guy's $350,000 computerized combine. So he really has this wide breadth of talent and knowledge. And I got going so much that I forgot what
the cannons. He collects real cannons.
Yeah, he doesn't collect them. He builds them. He makes them on his lathe. And he constructs them. He makes everything. He makes the spokes for the wooden wheels. He constructs them. He makes his own powder, which is slightly extra legal. And so I don't get into real depth there. But when you go to see him shoot his cannon, which he's happy to do, he doesn't just shoot the cannon. You learn about the Civil War, you learn about the Iron Brigade, you learn about Napoleonic cannons and the difference in the styles. And so, and you know what? Let's face it, he is one of those guys who likes to hear things go boom.
Michael Perry, my guest for the remainder of the hour, visiting Tom, his latest book. Mike, one of the so many parts of this book I related to, connected with, had such a vivid picture of where you live, some of the experiences that you have in that neck of the woods and in Wisconsin. One of the parts, and I don't know if you can read from it, is when you first visit Tom Hartwig's kitchen,
sure.
And there's a connection there with your present wife. I wonder if you could maybe read from that section and talk about that connection.
Yeah, I'll just read the section and reflect on it. The Hartwig kitchen, and by the way, he has a wife, Arlene. They've been married now. Well, in the book, they're trying to make their 60th anniversary. The Hartwig kitchen is small and close, dominated by the bulwark of a cast iron wood range dating to 1893. Add to that the encroaching cupboards, the kitchen sink and dish-stacked countertops, a refrigerator, a modern electrical stove, a small wall-mounted porcelain utility sink, and an overloaded coat rack, and there's not a lot of room to maneuver. The wooden floors are dark brown and unpolished, but worn to smoothness by over a century of boot soles. The table is always happily cluttered with mail and pens and notepads and cookies and saltines, and always a Skippy jar filled with peanut M&Ms. The worn floor, the dim corners, the bacon grease undertones. This is the same kitchen I've known from clear back to my Jane-sized days when we went to visit our neighbors in Sampson Township. These are not the kitchens of slick magazines and stainless steel appliances. These are kitchens of clutter and stack, of the dish rag hung and the pans piled, of the countertop ice cream buckets spilling onion husks and potato peels. Company is happily received with no preemptive clearing of the decks. Just clomp right in, boots and all. Your chair is waiting, more often than not left at an open angle, ready to receive the next visitor. And then I go on and I talk about all the kitchens of my youth and the different neighbors, and then sum it up by saying that when we visited our neighbors in those days, we just naturally sat in the kitchen. In fact, it would have felt stiff and strange to sit in the parlor. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, the first time I walked through the Hartwig's door and into that kitchen, I knew exactly where I was. And I was taken there by my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, and that became a pretty big deal. And I really didn't think about that till I was writing the book, that there's a little bit of a personal connection there. My wife was a farm girl, a couple farms down the road from Tom and Arlene, went through a tough stretch when her mom was going through a divorce. And my wife wound up working for Tom and Arlene, and it became a place, I think, of some shelter as well. And she was on his hay crew. As a matter of fact, when about the third time I went to see them and he realized I was getting serious, he said, "You see that young lady over there?" And he pointed at my then-girlfriend. I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "She was on my hay crew for 5 years." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "She outworked every boy I ever hired." And I said later I realized that was less a testament to her character than a challenge to my own. But when she took me to that kitchen the first time, it wasn't until I was writing the book that I realized what an important moment that had been in my perception of her. Because up to that time, I was attracted to her for a lot of reasons. But when I saw how she treated that old couple and how she respected them and honored them and did it comfortably in a roughneck kitchen, I realized that if she'd have me, I'd have her.
Michael Perry is my guest. Visiting Tom is his latest book. A major theme, perhaps the major theme of this book we haven't touched upon. I want you to comment on about it. In the 1950s, President Eisenhower signed the Federal Aid Highway Act. It was the great beginning of the creation of the interstate highway system, which has reshaped this country. It was in the mid-1960s that the interstate was put right through the middle of Tom's farm, your neighbor. Describe that experience for Tom.
Well, he's lived on that farm for all of his 82 years. And when he was a boy, he would jump off the porch and run past the barn and go down in the creek bottoms and play down there and hunt arrowheads. And then he'd cross the footbridge and walk to the one-room school. Very isolated. The only connection to the outside world was a dirt two-track, and even that winds out of sight around the ridge. So he had this very isolated existence, and he grew older, and he took over the farm. And when he was in his 30s, they drew a map somewhere in Washington, and it went right through his barn. And he got them – if you go there now, the interstate jogs just a titch and goes around his barn, and it's the only battle he won. And he went from this utterly isolated existence to now – and these are official numbers – he's got 22,300 vehicles a day going through his yard, 8.5 million a year. And it's been nonstop since they cut the ribbon in the 60s.
And a horrendous noise,
yeah,
constantly.
You can't escape it when you're in the kitchen, when you're in the – wherever you are on the farm. And what fascinates me about this is here he had this tremendous, perpetual, ongoing, unceasing disruption. And yet – and he will – if you read the book, he will go on an anti-government rant. But he lives a full life, an engaged life. He hasn't let this stop him. And ultimately, I think we're all looking for equanimity, and I'm fascinated with how he's achieved it.
Side by side, parallel to this story that you tell of his encounter with federal authorities and the interstate system being built right through his property, you describe your encounter with the man, shall we say,
yeah.
facing your problems. You live on a road called Starkey Road.
Yeah.
What's special about that? And they altered that.
Right. We live at the end of a very steep dead end. And in order to get up the hill, normally you just approach it and take a left-hand turn and go up the hill. But the minute you get just a skiff of snow, if you just start at the hill going up, you'll never make it. And it's been that way forever. And so what everybody always did going back 80, 100 years, and what we've always done is if it's snowing, you go around the county road curve and you go down the road about 3/4 mile and then you turn around and then you've got a straight shot at the hill and you just pour the cobs to her. And if you're not going double nickels when you hit the bottom of the hill, you're not going to make it. So the straight shot is essential. But the local highway commissioner decided to redesign the intersection and put one of those little safety hooks at the bottom, which may I just say, generally is an improvement. It really does help with safety, and I completely understand why he was doing it. But I tried to explain to him, if you do this at the bottom of our hill, we won't make it up. In his defense, and I really cover this in the book, he's got an impossible job. He's responsible for thousands of miles of road, and it's one of those jobs also where no one notices you until you do something they don't like. But to make a long story short, I lost the battle, and now we can't get up our hill in the winter. And so I use my little fight over 30 feet of asphalt as sort of a comic relief backdrop slash parallel to Tom's rather major battle.
I love reading this book also because Tom possesses a tremendous number of varied skills he's acquired over decades. You have a tremendous number of varied skills as well, Michael. You write of your love of your scythe and call it a cultural baton.
Yes. Well, one of the things I like about Tom is his ability to bring you right back to earth if you get carried away. And so I have this old scythe and I use it to cut my little patch of oats that I plant every year. And so I have a section in the book where I talk about preparing to cut, and I sharpen it with 3 different stones, and I'm contemplating the landscape and history and time. And then I cut ahead, and I get into a part here now where I'm talking about what I call the contemplative aesthetics. And I'm out actually cutting oats now. And I say, even as the heart thuds and the sweat falls, I'm appreciating the graceful curve of the wooden shaft. Its very shape is a sculptural implication of patience and craft. And the anatomical terms of the scythe, the nib, the heel, the tang, the snath, are the poetics of another age. And I go on like this for a little while, just talking about all these artistic elements of hard physical labor. And then I say, this whole philosophical angle has its limits. One day, Tom and I are rummaging in his machine shed for a piece of steel when I spy a scythe hooked in the rafters, just the same as mine. I start telling Tom about my scythe and how I've been using it. I tell him about how I sharpen it, using the 3 stones in sequence, keeping them wet, how I follow the arc of the blade. Yeah, sounds like you're doing that about right, he says. Inside, I glow a little. There are certain skills a man ought to have, and putting an edge on a blade is prime among them. To have Tom's approval in this instance is doubly meaningful. I tell him how I've been refining the way I swing the scythe, hoping he might give me some advice on how to better handle the thing, but he just says, yeah, that's pretty much how you do it. I'm feeling expansive now, not just because of his approval, but because I'm imagining it must be heartening for him, the old-timer, to know that some of us in the trailing generations are taking up the old ways again, studying them, doing our best to preserve fundamental traditions in the face of an uncertain future. The scythe is a cultural baton, and we are passing it down the generations. You know what really works good? Asked Tom. I give him my full attention, determined to keep my scatterbrain in focus so that whatever secret he's about to share, I will carry it forward, hand it to my own children, be a living link. Yeah. One of them gas-powered weed whackers.
Michael Perry, reading from his latest book, Visiting Tom. How does Tom Hartwig feel about you writing about him and then also going around the country imitating you?
Well, I can't answer that fully because Tom speaks for himself. He's a private guy. I asked his permission before I wrote about it. About him, and he gave me his permission with the contingency that I change his name. So I have given him a little bit of camouflage, although he's obviously very identifiable locally.
Well, you have pictures of him throughout
and,
the book.
And they have pictures, but he was fine with that. He signed all the paperwork on that. I think he understood that what I really wanted to do was write about larger things through him, and both the archetype of the old timer, but also about his commitment to his daughters and his wife and what I can learn from something like that. And it's about their love story. This couple, Arlene, figures in this book, and he talks about how he just couldn't have done what he's done without his wife. And so I think he understands I'm trying to do more than just write about him. But he's funny. He said, you got to change my name. And then I sat down for hours with him and with his wife and with his family to fact check and try to get all the details, because there's so much focus on that in memoir these days. And I'm very careful to try and get the facts straight. And if I make a mistake, I say so on my blog. But I got all done doing all this fact checking. And one day, you know, I said, well, are you okay with this, Tom? Oh, yeah. He said, it's fine. He goes, you changed my name, so I'm just telling people it's fiction. I said, oh, Tom, no, don't do that.
All of your books up to this point that I'm aware of have been nonfiction.
Yep.
Will you jump into fiction someday?
I better, because I'm about 3/4 of the way. I signed a contract with Harper to write a young adult fiction novel, and I'm about 3/4 of the way through it.
Ooh, do tell what you can.
Well, I'm behind. That's what I can tell you. It's about a young girl about the same age as my daughter, facing some difficult circumstances in a rough situation and trying to figure her way through that. She has a mentor very much like Tom. She hangs out with this old guy and takes advice from him and learns crafts. And no unicorns, no magic dust, I'm afraid.
How is that, jumping the fence, so to speak? You were just talking about fact-checking, getting things accurate. And now, as a fiction writer, you're allowed to make up things.
That it's actually harder, because you know there's so many directions to go. And I'm also a real respecter of genres. I'm going into this with all my heart, but I'm not assuming that I can pull it off, because genre is a big deal. And so I'm working hard at it, and I don't know. We'll see. It's supposed to come out early 2014 if I get my work done.
You have a writing room over your garage, which you mentioned in this book, a window through which you can see many, many things. You can eavesdrop on kids playing out. You can see when people are approaching your dead-end street there. But tell me about a typical writing day you have.
Well, there's not really a typical day, because I'm on the road about 80 to 100 days. I do a lot of performing and speaking and one-man shows in little theaters, and I do a lot of magazine writing, and I have to go on the road for that sometimes. And so I've learned over the years to just write whenever the opportunity presents itself, whether that's at my desk in my wonderful little space over the garage, or if it's in a waiting room somewhere at a public radio station.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, when I'm home, I used to start writing about 6 at night and go till 3, 4 in the morning. Now I'm a dad with little ones. I'm usually up by 6, 6:30, and I shoot out to that room and I write as long as I can in the morning and into the afternoon, because I want to be around for supper and bedtime with the kids, because mm-hmm. I'm gone so much.
Do you have a discipline about how much you need to write, or is it more of a story, an anecdote that you want to get crafted well?
No, and I don't want to sound flip here, but I truly am deadline driven. I'm full-time freelance, so if I don't write, we don't make the house payment. And if I don't get out and perform, we don't make the house payment. So I literally sit down and go, what do I have to write today? And I get after it. I love what I do. I'm the luckiest knucklehead in the world. I never set out to do this. I'm a farm kid with a nursing degree, for crying out loud.
Visiting Tom, the title of Michael Perry's latest book, A Man, a Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. He'll be reading this evening at Prairie Lights in downtown Iowa City. If you'd like to hear that or meet Michael Perry, that starts at 7 p.m. Well, you mentioned being out on the road, Mike, and part of what you do on the road is to perform with a band that you have, Michael Perry and the Long Beds. How does that fit in with your life?
Well, better than I expected. It's a real treat. And by the way, before I forget, I was just going to mention, if you go to sneezingcow.com or visitingtom.com, there's actually a video of Tom shooting the cannon.
Oh,
yeah, so you might have
a
look. But the music is a blast, and there's more info about that at sneezingcow.com.
We will give our listeners a blast of your music, if that's okay with you, on our way out.
Sure, you betcha.
Something, Michael, you are at the lead vocals here, Michael Perry and the Long Beds, somewhere south of Sunday. Thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me. It's always a treat.
River to River, produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. There comes the music. Production assistants, Caitlin Fry. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And we always welcome your comments. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. River to River, a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Somewhere Easter Tuesday, figured you were gone.